Hi, I'm Claire Mitchell QC. Welcome to the Witches of Scotland podcast. I'm a lawyer who specialises in miscarriage of justice cases, and we're bringing you this podcast because we want to tell you about the women who were accused, prosecuted, convicted, and ultimately executed as witches in Scotland.
I'm Zoe Venditozzi, and I'm a writer who's always had an interest in the witches, and I feel that this dark mark against Scotland needs a reckoning.
The campaign Witches of Scotland wants three things. Firstly, a pardon for all those convicted of witchcraft. Secondly, an apology for all those who were accused as witches. And finally, a national monument in recognition of all those who are affected by this terrible miscarriage of justice.
Over the forthcoming weeks, we'll be talking to a whole host of experts about the history and the modern day connections to the Witches of Scotland. Hello and welcome to the Witches of Scotland podcast. This is episode 44, somewhat remarkably and ridiculously. Today we are going to be speaking to one of the makers of the Witch Story podcast, but we'll talk about that later, because it just occurs to me, Claire, I'm just wondering, is there anything in the news that we need to talk about?
Well, I mean, once again, I've been taken by surprise by that question, Zoe, and I have here just three or four things which I can tell you about. So,
marvellous.
First of all, this week, we have been speaking to The Observer magazine about our campaign, The Witches of Scotland, and hopefully you'll be able to read that soon. And also, probably with a different demographic, we've been speaking to the People's Friend.
That's quite exciting for me personally, because I got my start at The Friend. You can call it The Friend when you've worked there. I started off there as a trainee sub-editor 7 or 8 million years ago, and actually edited, amongst other things, From the Manse Window, which is quite exciting, which is where a different minister would write a wee story about their, I was going to say exploits, but that's probably the wrong word to use in connection with a minister. I'm sure
they didn't write about their exploits, Zoe.
They really didn't. And I did the letters page and I did the queries page. So that was an exciting time in a 23-year-old's life, let me tell you. And in fact, I was maybe 21 at that point. I was very young. And they told me I was too old to work for Shout magazine, which people that will know anything about magazines of the late 90s, mid to late 90s. That was the teen offering from DC Thompson's, but they thought I was too old at 21.
What?
Yeah, in my memory, the other staff that worked there were all in their 30s. So I think maybe they just didn't like my face. I don't know. I certainly wasn't a good fit for the People's Friend, I could tell you that much. But anyway, I was there for a year and a half. So it's quite nice to be interviewed by them now, to have us on the other side, as it were, to have an article. So that's pretty cool. And anything else?
We've done a lot of podcast recording recently, and we've got a lot of great people lined up to speak to. We recently spoke to Leonard Lowe, the author of The Wheam Witch, instantly recognisable name. And actually, when we spoke to him, he had so many interesting things to show us. We actually thought it might be better as a video. So we might do a sort of a short podcast with him, but possibly a video, so that if we put it up on YouTube, people can see the things that he was showing us. We also spoke to Matthew Bridson, an academic who has done a thesis on the Lancashire witches. And that was absolutely fascinating, speaking to him about the stories of those people accused and killed as witches there. And coming up, we've got a few different people, including the Massachusetts senator who is behind the campaign to have the last Salem witch pardoned. And we've also got an agreement to speak with Professor Mickey Brott, who's going to speak to us about her academic research on the Witches of Scotland. And finally, and some celebrations, Zoe, we've managed to get in contact with Louise Yeoman, who has agreed to speak to us. And that's great, because we've been trying to track her down for quite a while. So apart from that, we've got about another at least 10 people to speak to in the pipeline. So definitely very busy times.
Very exciting.
And the third thing is, I suppose, in the news, it's big news this week. On the 22nd of October, we're kicking off the Greyfriars Kirk Festival with a talk about the Witches of Scotland campaign. The Kirk itself, Greyfriars Kirk, has particular significance as it's the resting place of Christian Shaw. And listeners to the podcast will know that she was the complainer in the last big Paisley witch trial. So if you go back to episode 9, Julia Campanelli tells the story of Christian Shaw, but that's something we're looking forward to. And anything else, Zoe, in the news?
Well, yes, I came across an article yesterday that I found quite interesting in The Guardian. It's about the Sami people who are asking the Danish Queen to return their sacred witchcraft trial drum. So I'm going to read some of the stuff out of The Guardian article. So the Norway's Sami people are asking for a sacred drum confiscated by Denmark after a witchcraft trial way back in 1691 to be returned to them. The drum belonged to a Sami shaman, Anders Poulsen, who was arrested and imprisoned, according to court records of the time. When this was confiscated, it became part of the Danish royal family's art collection and in 1849 was transferred over to Denmark's National Museum. But understandably, the Sami people want it back. So the Sami Museum in Karasjok, I hope I'm saying that correctly, sent a request to the Danish National Museum earlier this year to formally take over ownership of the drum. And the president of the Sami Parliament, Eli Keskitalo, has issued a statement to Norwegian and Danish press demanding the drum's return. Keskitalo said, "This is a ceremonial sacred object of high cultural value used to predict the future and get in touch with the spirit world by Sami shamans throughout history. Only a few such drums still exist, with most in European hands, including one held, surprise, surprise, by the British Museum. This is a big issue for us," said Keskitalo, "that such important objects are stored in museum cellars where Sami people cannot see or study them." Keskitalo said, "We've been asking for years. It's unacceptable." Because the drum was part of the royal collection in Denmark before it was part of the National Museum, Keskitalo hopes the Queen of Denmark may act as the conscience of the Danish people and the Danish state. "I am hopeful that if she says that ownership should be transferred, it will be transferred," said Keskitalo. Queen Margrethe has yet to respond. The Sami Parliament also points to the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, adopted by Denmark and Norway. It says gives it the right to own the historic artefact. "Through this drum, we will be able to explain so much about Sami history. It tells a story about emancipation and the Sami struggle to own our culture," added Keskitalo. "The drum is the key to explaining our heritage." I fully agree. I think we've got no right, you know, other countries going around taking people's things and then keeping them. It was ridiculous. I remember years and years ago, now I'll get the probably the most important parts of this story wrong, but the broadly the point I'm making stands. Yonks ago, when I was at university in Glasgow, the museum in Kelvin Grove, like, you know, the big Kelvin Grove Museum, had, I think, well, I want to say a war dress from one of the Native American groups of people, one of the tribes. And I think that that has now been given back again. But it was on display, and this is back in sort of like the sort of early 90s. And it was appalling. Like, you can't, I don't think you should keep things like that. And I think especially now, when it's so easy to digitize, to photograph, to display things, there's no need to keep these artifacts. Even if you would argue that it's of significance and people should learn about it, give stuff back. Like, you know, it's not the Victorian cataloguing times. Give stuff back. And then if people want to go and have a look at it, they can travel to that country or they can probably look at it online. So I fully support the Sami people asking for their drum back. It's ridiculous.
It is.
Hopefully the Danes will be sensible.
It is ridiculous, and I think the hashtag give stuff back is a good one. A powerful message there, Zoe.
Thanks very much. That is why I'm a professional writer. Thanks very much. Is there any more news?
No, but I was going to tell you a pretty horrifying thing, in fact, about a really, really famous slogan. I saw that the man who'd invented the slogan for Nike, "Just Do It," has just died. So that was interesting, I thought. That wasn't what the horror of it was. The horror was that the article that I read said the "just do it" phrase had been taken from a convicted murderer's last words.
What the heck?
I know. I'm sorry, listeners, we've gone completely off-piste. But I thought that is an inspiration.
It's not off-piste, is it? It's not off-piste because actually, arguably, what it is that people that have got position of power using their power to take things from people that have been convicted of things. So it very much ties in with the witch trial in that respect. I don't know if the murderer of which you refer to was actually a murderer or if it was a miscarriage of justice, but it's pretty crazy and it's not very tasteful.
No, I did think, what? People are wearing that as a... I mean, I know the slogan's meant for a different reason, but yeah. Can I just say, I applaud your ability to be able to link those two things and pull me... I was like heading down a black slope of irrelevance and you pulled me right back there and got me on piste, Zoe, so well done.
Thank you very much. That's good. I was actually watching a film last night. I don't know whether this will make it into the final cut, called Zombieland Double Tap, which is the second film about Woody Harrelson doing killing.
I am acquainted with this movie.
Claire and I both, you may not know this, listeners, both are enormous fans of the zombie genre. I love a zombie film. And he was trying to come up with a new slogan. And the slogan he came up with towards the end of the film was, let's kick some dicks. So I think that's worse. I don't know if that'll make it.
I'm not wearing a t-shirt when I exercise saying that, Zoe.
No, but then also part of me quite liked it, strangely. But then I'm also the same person that when I was about 20, I very nearly, and I'm so glad I didn't do this, had a tattoo done of the Nike tick. So I know. And I have got tattoos, none of which are of the Nike tick or any other sporting symbols. Obviously, I mean, that'd be ridiculous. But yeah, so, you know, you can do things when you're young or have ideas when you're young that you're really glad that you don't see through.
I'm so kids, glad.
Don't do it, kids. Don't get a Nike tick tattoo. Because then you know that you're just referencing a murderer's final words.
Yeah.
Just do it.
I don't think our demographic probably are high on the getting the Nike swoosh as a tattoo, but good advice in any event. Quickly moving on.
Yes, let's please move on. So, Claire, have you been doing some research this week?
Yes, as usual, we talk about a number of people who were women, not witches, people who we remember as those that suffered a terrible miscarriage of justice that were accused. And this week I focused on things that were ritual items, meaning that in the course of whatever it was that they were doing, they used things. And one of them, when I scrolled down the list that you could look up, one of them that caught my attention are fingernails. And strangely, the reason that that brought to my attention is one of my friends, who's quite a superstitious person, explained to me that if you cut your nails, you never leave the nail cuttings inside your house. You always throw them outside of the house.
Does it count if your children put them down the drain in the bathroom?
I think that would be okay. I'm not sure. I didn't go into the detail, but I think it's funny that we have these superstitions around physical things like hair, or nails that we've got rid of. And that seems to have gone through the history of these people too.
Is that because somebody could take the nails and then use them in a spell against you?
Yeah, or transfer something that was affecting you to somebody else. Mm. So it's a wee bit Howard Hughes. You know, you have to make sure that if you're disposing of any part of your hair or nails or whatever, you have to do it so other people can't get them. But I thought it was strange that these are sort of ideas that continue on but were involved in these cases. So the first case is that of Jonet Davidson. Poor Jonet had two accusations made against her, the first in April 1597. In her trial in 1597, she was accused of causing death by bewitchment. It was said she met with the devil and there was dancing and there was devil worship. She described the devil as some sort of a beast and also made reference to the devil at points being invisible. It was said she used nail trimmings and also she used cloths of various colours. The claim made against her was that she had a piece of paper on which there was writing and that her neighbour took ill after picking it up. So that was the first accusation made against her. The other accusation was made in 1598, a year later, where she was accused by four people, two married couples, of being a witch. She denied the accusations, which seemed vague, and unusually the presbytery allowed her to call witnesses to support her counterclaim of slander. So she said that they were just slandering her. There seems to have been a disagreement between her and one of the other women, and this appears to have been a case of slander between Jonet and the wife of one of the accusers. After the trial, which included both accusations, she was acquitted of witchcraft, but was called an inverted commas evil neighbour and ordered to be banished to the south. and she was told that if she returned again, she would be burnt. Now, this is an example of why we want an apology, Zoe, because this woman's life was ruined by witchcraft accusations. And if we simply dealt with the people that were pardoned, then it would be overlooking all those people like Jonet Davidson, who was accused and her life was obviously ruined by those accusations, forced to leave home, perhaps family, perhaps friends, on pain of coming back and being burnt, as is said there. The next person I want to talk about is a man who was accused of witchcraft called John Dougal. This is an unusual case due to the length of time the accusations were made. He was first accused in June 1695, but the case wasn't concluded till March 1700. So for 5 years, there was an accusation of witchcraft hanging over him. He is described as a charmer in the records, and sadly, not the way that we describe someone as a charmer these days, but it had a very different meaning then. He was indicted with others accused of what was described as tormenting children. The Survey of Scottish Witchcraft records that he seems to be a straightforward faith healer who got caught up in a batch of accusations and 1699 prosecutions. So in 1699, there were other prosecutions. Those other women accused in 1699 were called Bessie Cochrane, Jean Drummond, Isabel Houston, Janet Lang, Bessie Miller, Mary Morrison, John Patterson, Annabel Reed, Elspeth Tarbett, and Jean Woodrow. In his charms, wrongly attributed to witchcraft, he used a number of artifacts. He used hair as a charm to cure, and he used objects to heal. He used a round tree belt wrapped 9 times around the round tree to cure what is described as frigidity. He also used nail clippings and eyebrow hair and hairs from the crown of the head and half a penny wrapped in cloth. He told witnesses to sow some milk in with corn on Beltane Day. He told another man to boil a young cow and burn the rest of the bones to ashes and then bury them. Dougal said that this would cure the animal of disease within the rest of the beasts. He was noted unsuccessfully healing at a girl, and it's said in the survey that he seemed to be better at healing animals. He used charms to heal frigidity and convulsions. Hair, money and nails were left, so whomever found them would get the disease and remove it from the first person. So that's what you were saying there, Zoe, and I was wondering whether or not the reason or the idea has come down that if you cut your nails, you remove them and you take them out of the house and put them in the bin. Does that come from the same root, that you didn't want someone in your own family to pick them up and be afflicted with whatever you were trying to get rid of? You know, it's interesting how these things happen. Anyway, the procedural history of the trials were that the Presbytery and Kirk Sessions investigated and questioned witnesses and the suspect between June 1695 and November 1965 for the first set of accusations. On the first occasion, it was decided that public repentance and censure would be enough, and therefore nothing happened to him in a formal sense in relation to the witchcraft accusation. His name was also given to the local sheriff, so he was obviously a marked man at that point, that these accusations had been made, they're not proved. However, unfortunately for him, he appears to have got caught up in these later 1699 accusations. When looking at what happened to all the people I mentioned, including him, the High Court records show that the diet was deserted. That simply means that the trial was pulled. There was no more done. The trial didn't proceed. This was also recorded in relation to the diet of those others. So very much hopefully this means that what happened is when they went to court, the court just said, we're not hearing these, deserted the diet, as it's called formally, and it means that the case didn't proceed. And hopefully that was an end to the matter and they weren't re-prosecuted. But of course, for many years, they had to suffer the fate of being recorded as a witch. Zoe, I think you've got one more to tell us about.
So I've got one more, and this woman was called Bessie Wright. She was 42 and is recorded as being of middling economic status. And in fact, her bail was £1,000, which seems like quite a lot of money, you would
think.
That
seems like a huge amount of money. Yeah. I was thinking middling status must mean something approaching the middle class then, if there was such a thing. I'm not sure.
And I wonder whether that was set deliberately high so that she wouldn't avail herself of the bail. I don't know, that seems strange.
Quite possible.
So it appears that she was a healer, and in 1611, she was reprimanded and told to stop using cures. But then in April 1626, that's 15 years later, she was accused of witchcraft. The main accusation appears to be relating to healing rituals and advice that didn't work. So she agreed to refrain from using her cures, especially in the borough of Perth. The 1628 accusations were in part a result of her infringement of this promise. The case has some interesting details about the herbs and other ingredients that she used in her salves, and they included ripple grass. So that's described here as being ripple grass or robwort plantain, wafran leaf, plantain, feather, fingly, which might be fennel possibly, and hyssop. She denied she'd used fox tree leaves, foxglove. Now they're poison, aren't they? That's digitalis, isn't it?
Yes.
She also claimed that she had her skill from the possession of a book that had belonged to her father and grandfather. She said it was 1,000 years old, but as she could not read it, her son, Adam Bell, would read out bits to her. The book was taken from her during the ministry of William Cowper, who was minister between 1595 and 1612. So the question is, does the Kirk still have that book? And if so, where is it?
Yeah, I mean, that would be really interesting. If that book, clearly, it looks like it had been passed down for generations, it got to her and it was seized from her. It would be so interesting to find out what was in that book. But
Was that minister in Perth?
It seems to be, yes.
Let's do some research into that. If anybody has any idea there, if there's some sort of manuscript area within Perth for the churches where they keep things, do let us know. We'll do a bit of research into that as well with our contact within the ministry. Very interesting.
Yeah, it would be. I mean, you've got to think either, I suppose, it was just destroyed there and then,
yeah,
or it might still be somewhere, which would be absolutely fascinating. If
that really would be.
So we remember those people accused as witches who were not witches, but women and men. Jonet Davidson, John Dougal, Bessie Cochran, Jean Drummond, Isabel Houston, Janet Lang, Bessie Miller, Mary Morrison, John Patterson, Annabel Reid, Elspeth Tarbett, Jean Woodrow, and Bessie Wright.
So today's podcast, we're excited to be speaking to Kayla Canzora, who joined us all the way from Toronto in Canada. She is one of the two co-producers and hosts of Witch Story, which is a bi-weekly podcast where Kayla, with her co-host Stephanie, discuss trials and tales of witches throughout the centuries. Each episode sheds new light on a story, bringing attention to the thousands of people who've been persecuted as witches around the world. Really, really fascinating, and we're delighted to be talking to Kayla today. I am absolutely delighted with our guest today, and it's quite an interesting person we're going to speak to, because today we, as the Witches of Scotland podcast, are going to be speaking to Witch Story podcast. So it's podcast to podcast, and we do sort of the same sort of subject area, but they're not really the same sort of thing. But I think I'll let our guest today tell you all about that. The hosts of Witch Story are actually Stephanie and Kayla, but we're just speaking to Kayla today. But hopefully, Kayla, you can fill us in on everything that Stephanie would say as well. If you could just tell us a wee bit about yourself, Kayla, and your background, and maybe Stephanie's too, that would be great.
So Steph and I actually met at university. She was a medieval studies major and I majored in archaeology. So our friend groups would overlap as they're all history based. And we clicked immediately. And initially for our podcast, Witch Story, I was thinking about writing a book, and I can get into that a little bit later if you'd like, but I didn't know how to get accountable. I needed to feel like somebody was doing it with me. So for all the chapters in the book, they became episodes on Witch Story. And yeah, Steph decided immediately that she wanted to help me out with that. And I think she's great. She's very knowledgeable in the history of witchcraft. And I'm more knowledgeable in the more ancient history. So yeah, two heads combined and we made our podcast.
And you're based in Canada. Are you both in Toronto?
Yeah, she's a little bit outside of the city, but I would say Toronto based. Yeah.
Okay. And you've been releasing podcasts now, I think, since February. Is that right? February of 2021. Great. And you do them quite frequently, don't you?
We started off with an episode a week. And then during the summer, when I went back to work, because I do archaeology in the summertime, we went to every 2 weeks, we were putting out an episode. Yes.
Pretty much the same as what happened to us. We were putting out an episode during the pandemic, one a week. But then when things started to pick up with everything else and work, we dropped down to one every second week. And actually, I think our listeners prefer it because we were putting out so much content that they hardly had time to keep up.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, it was definitely a pandemic thing for us. I was bored at home and I was like, how do I get creative here? So, yeah, that was fun.
So why specifically witches? Of all the things that you've studied and you've looked at, why did you decide to focus on the story of different witches?
So I love history. I love culture. What really interested me in witches specifically was that every single culture, every single country I was looking at and researching had their own idea of a witch, whether it was like a witch or a medicine woman or a, I don't know, a hag, you know, the Baba Yaga or something. Every country, every culture had that. And it really makes everyone more connected looking at the folk tales of their country. And in Canada, a lot of people don't know anything about witch persecutions. It's not like in Scotland where it's such a huge part of your history. We don't really have that. When you talk about witch persecutions, people might know about Salem in Massachusetts, but that's really the extent of it. So this really gets people informed, gets the information out there. So
we were actually very much the same in Scotland. Zoe and I have talked about it and talked with various experts that come on. We weren't taught about it in school. We only found out about it effectively through word of mouth, through people talking about it and local communities having set up, you know, stones which commemorate things that we could look at and think, what's that, and find out more. But apart from academics who are working in their own area and providing academic books, it didn't really trickle down into society much, into people knowing about these things. And that was one of the reasons we wanted to do the podcast as well. So was there in Canada witch trials there?
Yes, but they're very different. So I feel like I have to back up a little bit and talk about the history of Canada, if that's okay. It's mostly until the late 15th century, it was mostly the Indigenous peoples. So we have the First Nations, the Inuit and the Métis, and then late 15th century, Britain and France colonized. And because of that, we have a lot of those older laws, but it only really took effect in around, I think, 1895 was our section 365, which was basically against people pretending to be witchcraft to commit fraud or extortion. So we never really had the exact same trials where people would be like hung for witchcraft or burned for witchcraft or any of that stuff, because it was a lot later. And if you think about it, the Salem trials were in 1692 and we got that law in 1892. So it's very recent. But we have had in Quebec, which is New France, it was settled by the French. We have had a lot of smaller trials there, but they were never finished or they never were condemned for witchcraft. There was always something else. Like, for example, this one person was sentenced for witchcraft, but he ended up, his crime that he was killed for ended up being selling alcohol, because at that time it was illegal. So we didn't really have hung for witchcraft per se here, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. There were so many people that had come across from Britain and also from France. They will have had their own generational stories, I suppose, of the witch trials that they had experienced or had heard of from their home nations. So I suppose that would be in the culture that they had brought over.
Yeah, so one of the examples of that is the Ursuline nuns. When they came here in, I think, 1660 to an area called, I'm going to butcher this, but Trois-Rivières, so the Three Rivers area. And when they were first settling there, we had the Ursuline nuns and the Jesuits. And I think they got really scared of the local people who were the Iroquois at the time. And they made up these wild stories about hearing people flying on like a devil's fired up canoe and stuff like that. And they ended up having a trial where there was a woman who was quote unquote possessed by a man who was trying to have relations with her that she didn't want. And you see the same possession trials back in France at the same time or a little bit earlier. So it's very connected because I don't think a lot of other places when they do witch trials, it's possession based. Right. So you do see that relation that they brought their witchcraft thoughts over to Canada for sure.
And you mentioned at the beginning there that you are writing a book and that you structured the podcast through sort of, you know, chapter with different stories. How did you hone in on particular stories?
So the idea for the book was actually going to be a coffee table style book where every 2 to 3 pages would be a new chapter. And I wanted to take a story from, it's hard to do every country, especially in Canada and America, because the Indigenous peoples, they don't conform to, you know, the borders per se that we have now, but I wanted to take something from every culture and make that a chapter. So every single chapter would be a trial, a persecution, or story in witchcraft. But it just got so big so fast that I have probably over 300 names that I want to look at, you know. And when you're looking at something from a different country or culture, you really have to dive in and get to know the entirety of their history, backgrounds, and religions to tell one story because it's different everywhere. So, yeah.
Yeah, Keila, that is, I mean, we're struggling to do that studying only our own culture and history. So yeah. Good luck to you with that. That's a hell of an amount of work you've got carved out for yourself.
I don't know if you ever feel the way that when you tell a story and then you upload it in a podcast, a couple months later, somebody tells you something about it that you didn't know and you want to go back and put it in, but you can't because it's already uploaded into the world.
Yeah. But I suppose when you do the book, you can have those extra bits woven in, I guess. That'd be quite helpful. And are there any of the stories that you thought you knew an idea about it, and then when you did research, it turned into something different or more complex as you discovered more about it?
For sure. I have a lot uploaded into like my Google Docs right now where I thought I researched everything and then I'm ready to record with Steph. And then all of a sudden I tell somebody that I'm going to record. One of our most recent ones was an ancient witch prince of China episode. And I had a friend and coworker tell me all of this stuff that he knew about ancient China and like the medicines and stuff. And I was just like, all right, I guess we can't upload this week. We're going to have to
do a bit more.
Almost every episode, I get some sort of feedback where somebody says what they actually think happened. And it's really interesting because everyone has a different perspective.
Is there much historical evidence or documentation for a lot of the stories? If you talk about different lots of different cultures and really very far back through time, is a lot of it kind of mythological stories that have grown over time?
I think so, yes, but it's very hard sometimes finding research, especially if the research is not in English, which I know it's kind of bad for me to say I wish everything was in English, but we had somebody from the Witch and Bitchin podcast, Elena, and they helped us with a Finnish witch trial. And every time I try to do any research on the exact same trial, it would lead me nowhere. I would get like a coffee shop with a trial name, or I would get something from another country. I wouldn't find any information. So for them to give me all that research, and it was really ingrained, since it's Finnish, it was really ingrained with their culture and their folklore.
It can be very difficult. I mean, obviously, as Claire's already mentioned, we're just focusing obviously on the witches of Scotland. And a lot of great work's been done by different historians and researchers. And we use the information for the most part that other people have put together. I mean, Claire and I are not historians. So we're very much approaching this from an interested contemporary bystander sort of role. But there is quite good documentation for various aspects of the Witches of Scotland. So we're looking at it more because of Claire's legal background, I would say, as things that are kind of provable that have been documented and often in a legal sense. So it's kind of more straightforward from us in that way that we're, as Claire said, we're just this culture in Scotland in mostly in English. I mean, some of it's older English, or it's maybe a wee bit of Scots or something, but it's pretty straightforward for us to kind of get to grips with that. For you to be covering witch stories of the world, right back, you know, through many, many hundreds of years, that's a really big task, isn't it? But so fascinating.
Yeah, and I think with Scotland, England, probably France as well, I think there is a really good deal of documentation in history. For example, in Canada, before Britain and France settled, there was no written history. There was absolutely no written documentation. Everything that we know now is through archaeology or oral traditions. Mm-hmm. So I talk to a lot because I work with a lot of First Nations liaisons, and they always tell me a lot about, you know, the folk medicine woman and the medicine man and all that. But there is nothing actually written in history that would give us evidence for that. Or because I'm half Polish and I would love to do more Polish trials, but not a lot of it is written or saved after all the wars and stuff. So
yeah.
Some of our experts have told us that because of the effect of the witch trials in Scotland, a lot of folk medicine and charming, i.e. not devil worship, but charms that people used to do, were themselves lost because people just stopped talking about them. They didn't want to be passing down from one generation to the next something that could be considered a charm, just in case somebody thought that they were doing it with the devil's involvement and that would be witchcraft in some way. And I also spoke to, interestingly, a drugs expert who traces the use of natural remedies that we used to use as drugs to try and help people. And again, that person said that in Scotland, part of our history had been lost again by the 200 years of witch trials, because people didn't want to talk about alternative remedies with charms, with these sorts of things. And essentially for 200 years in Scotland, conversation was shut down. So a lot of our history, in fact, comes from the written records of the persecutors, the pursuers, from the kirks and from books about, for example, local council books on how many people had to be employed to watch over a woman so she didn't sleep while she was being interrogated. So it's a shame that we have so much information, but most of the information comes from those that were doing the witch hunting and not the oral tradition passed down from people. And I think, am I right, Zoe, that when we talked to Laurie in Shetland, she spoke about the really strong oral tradition of the islands and why they knew much more about those sorts of things.
Yeah, definitely. And as you're saying there, you know, they're generally illiterate because it would just be people that had money that would have access to an education that would provide them the tools to actually write things down. But I think also, you know, I'm again not a historian, but I think that a lot of cultures obviously were oral cultures because there wasn't a means of writing things down. And that as time went on, I suppose things would change or would crystallize in particular ways. We were just talking to an expert earlier about the way that charms were passed down. And it's interesting because if there was, as it would have been in Scotland, like a real climate of fear, you wouldn't want to have anything that could be identified as you're a witch in your house or about your person. So it would really need to be, as far as possible, oral, I suppose, so that you couldn't be forced to give it up until, of course, you were being tortured, I suppose, or sleep deprived into making a confession and giving something up.
For the listeners, have you or are you going to cover some Scottish witches?
I would love to, absolutely. Steph and I have both been to Scotland multiple times. It is one of my favourite countries. I've also done those like touristy witchy tours in Edinburgh and stuff. I just think that for doing Scotland, because it's so massive, you know, all of the history, that I just really want to, if we do like a small case, I really want to incorporate and do it justice. Mm-hmm. Which is going to be hard, but yeah, there's so many names I have that when you just like type them in, it's just like Scotland, right? So there's a lot, and it's going to be hard to pick one. Steph researched an episode that we did on Gaelis, yeah. Gaelis Morgan, But I think we did that more because she's already, the name is already known from obviously Outlander, and because it started the Barrick trials. But we do want to look more closely, and we have a lot that we're slowly researching, but we'll get there. Maybe we'll have you on the show to help us out.
Oh, please do. That'd be very exciting.
We would be totally delighted to help you in any way. We would love to be on the show, but also we'd be able to put you in contact with lots of people that would be able to tell you more. We totally feel the problem that you've got, because we started off our podcast thinking we would do six, as we always said, and we show no signs of slowing. In fact, we appear to be accelerating in numbers of people that we're going to be speaking to. So, yeah, so I can see why doing that in a single podcast would be very... would be very difficult.
Yeah, it's also hard that we don't have access to archives or anything right now, especially because of COVID. Like, even if I could find something in the local library, Ontario, at least the province I live in, is pretty locked down still. So it's hard to just do most of the research that you want to do. But yeah, I'd love that. And please don't stop. I feel like we're really big fans on Twitter. We're always liking stuff. So it's so nice to actually be able to finally talk.
Yeah, it's great. It's amazing how, or maybe it's not amazing, how incredibly popular the issue of witches, both in terms of the history and the trials and miscarriages of justice, and also being a witch or being interested in witch sort of practicing and spells and charms and so on. It's amazing to me how popular that is. Do you have a lot of people that follow your podcast that would identify themselves as witches?
So it's a little tricky because it's so popular to get into Wicca and witchcraft and this idea of neo-paganism and all that stuff. But I do see a lot of people not knowing about the history of witchcraft. So I do get a lot of people who message us. We have listeners from all over the world, I think at least 30 countries, but we have people messaging us like, I didn't know anything about this, you know, and then incorporating that into their practice. Or some people do ancestor worship and then realize their ancestors might not have been that great, you know? So
yeah,
we get a lot of messages like that. We get some people thinking that they are reincarnations of the witches we've talked about. And as much as I'd like to, I don't want to say believe them, but you know, be accepting of that, we get a lot of that, and gets a little creepy sometimes too.
Yeah, it's quite strange. We've talked about this before, about how some people really very strongly identify with people that were executed as witches, and potentially maybe that's because they've had trauma in their own lives, or they've had difficulty and they can see this is somebody that was persecuted, and I feel like I've been persecuted in some way. So they have a kind of a bond through time, or like a bond through story or something like that. So it's quite interesting from that point of view about what drives people, particularly because we're a podcast that seeks to educate, but is also very tied to our campaign. So we want to see this miscarriage of justice redressed and talked about in Scotland so that people know about it as part of their history. But I think it's really interesting for people to think about, well, hang on, these people back in Scotland, I'm talking about, but in Scotland were just people. Like, they did not consider themselves as witches because they were very God-fearing and very Christian at that time, and that they didn't view themselves as witches for the most part, even if they did charms or they practiced what we would call sort of some aspects of witchcraft now. They believed in a magic, some of them, but they wouldn't have categorized themselves as witches. So I think it's really interesting for us to kind of shed a light through different experts coming on about, well, actually, this person was just an ordinary person, and there might have been quite a mundane reason for them being accused of being a witch. It might have been that they had land that their son-in-law wanted, or it might have been that they fell out with somebody in the community, or it might have been they were a bit weird, or they looked different, or, you know, that's really interesting to me, is sort of going back all the time to whatever facts we have and whatever documentation we have and saying to people, well, this is the reality of it. I find that really interesting.
Yeah, so going back a little to what you said, that history is pretty much only written by, you know, the people who were doing the persecutions. Yeah. We try to do every episode with, like you said, just the straight facts, but then we look at it after and talk about, okay, what is the reality and what is the... if you believe in magic, what could have happened, you know? And I think that now a lot of the time because we don't know the real stories, that a lot of it can be romanticized for sure. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's just, I mean, one of the people we had message us, I don't know if I'm allowed to say this because I don't want them coming after me, but we did an episode on a Bavarian witch named Walpurga Hausmannin. And, you know, she was thought to have maybe have been a child murderer. And they messaged us saying that they are the reincarnation of that person. And now they are doing angel work and helping children because they were really bad in their past. And I didn't know what to do with that. I was like, did you murder children? And now you're saying you're sorry? Like, what am I supposed to do with that?
That's so interesting. And by interesting, I mean weird.
Yeah.
Oh, it's a bit strange. Yeah. And I suppose you will have some people that do connect with that in some way themselves, and I guess are working through different things. I mean, at least if they are the reincarnation, that they've not decided to go on murdering children, that they're trying to turn it around. So that's change is possible. We all change as people, even reincarnations of witches that kill children.
Well, I mean, the point of reincarnation is change.
No, true.
I mean, the point is to come back as a better person. So, yeah. And many people do believe in reincarnation, but they don't usually have the thoughts of the person before. You know, you don't usually know who you're reincarnated as. Mm-hmm. Our listeners, for the most part, get in contact and they've really connected with the idea that people were, as one of the monuments says, monument up in Orkney, they were just folk. And people really connect with that practicality of it. Like, they were just people going about their business who were involved in this really, really terrible time. But that's not to say that we don't also have a lot of people that consider themselves modern day witches following us as well, and really, really support the idea that people who were charmers or who just were completely innocent should also be pardoned. Have you had a wee thought about our campaign? What do you think of the idea of pardons and apologies and memorials?
So I believe a couple months ago, you shared the links on Instagram.
Yeah.
And yeah, we did too. We got a bunch of people. So if you see Canada, 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 hopefully we made an impact.
Okay.
But thank you.
Fully, fully supportive. Yeah, especially as we talked, like, it was a lot of normal folk. Like, we have people who just owed some money that are now being a witch. And I do think there needs to be more justice and more information about it. Because, you know, it's not only women, it's not only people that live in the countryside. It was a lot of the population might have been at once thought of to be or convicted for being a witch.
Are there any particular stories that are based in Canada that you think that our listeners might have an interest in?
So, as I said before, France had a lot of history from their country that they brought into what is now Quebec or New France. And there was a lot of cases there that I think tried to be put on trial, but never succeeded in being a quote unquote witchcraft trial. So they're harder to find, because if you type in witchcraft trial, you might not find it. But if you find like early, I don't know, murder cases, you might be able to. So there was a man named René de Bourgeois, I think his name was, and going after a woman. She didn't like him. She had a husband that she was marrying, and he was like, no, I'm not going to let this happen. So he was thought to have put a sterile spell on the new couple so that they were unable to have children. And eventually their marriage was annulled because you had to have children. And it was because of magic, but he was only banished from the colony he lived in. He wasn't killed or anything. And then we also have a lot of possession cases where people are taken over by demons. We had somebody in Nova Scotia, so also another East Coast province, where I think he was a farmer and owed a lot of money. And I think one of the women that he owed the money to, her husband died. And she said that he put a spell on her husband and he blew some powder into his face. and that caused a high fever and he ended up dying. And I think the judge saw all of the money he owed and was just like, we're just gonna cancel this case because you clearly just owe money. So that's a lot of the cases where I think the judges realized, no, this wasn't magic. This wasn't sorcery or witchcraft in the end, which is very different.
Yeah, yeah. From here, where we were looking for witchcraft, wherever we could possibly find it, we had totally that mindset. It's really interesting, Kayla, that the two examples you give us are both of men as well. And I'm wondering, when you're looking at things generally across the world, are most of the people accused of witchcraft in your researches so far women?
Most are women, yes. I think Iceland, Finland, Estonia were predominantly men that I've seen. Like upwards of 60% of the cases were men. A lot of families were persecuted together. There are still a lot of persecutions going on today with witchcraft that I would love to talk about, but I feel awkward because it's a very sensitive topic. I mean, these people's families are still out there. It would be kind of like doing a true crime case at this point, you know?
Yeah.
But I think that there should definitely be light shed on those topics.
Absolutely. We follow Leo Igwe, who's a humanist. He set up something called Advocacy for Alleged Witches, which you can look at on Facebook. And every couple of days he posts from various places where he's doing advocacy for people who are accused and going to them if he can, or interceding with authorities to try and have witchcraft accusations taken away, and does really, really great work in trying to ensure that modern day accusations don't lead to the same thing. But unfortunately, Leo's only one person and there are so many in the modern day. We were really heartened recently to see that there's been a UN regulation which basically requires countries to address the issue of witchcraft and report back to the UN. It does put some kind of formal pressure on them to show that they're doing something. So we really hope that that helps as well.
I really hope that helps, but I feel like a lot of other cultures might wiggle their way in and say, like, no, we believe this is a demonic thing. We don't think that it's your idea of witchcraft, so we're not going to tell you because this is, in our culture, a bad whatever it may be, and we have to get rid of it.
Yeah.
So
Leo did talk about the difficulties, particularly from people coming from another area, talking about witchcraft, and he goes into that in quite a lot of detail about the problems that NGOs and stuff like that have interacting with different cultures. And that's why he feels he benefits from being from a country which has a lot of witchcraft accusations, for him to be able to say, no, this isn't my culture you're talking about, and to be able to deal with that, because he says it's no part of my culture to just target vulnerable people. And sadly, that seems in so many of the cases, that's what happens and still happens. The people who are being targeted across the world just now with such accusations still seem to be predominantly those that are more vulnerable in society, usually women.
Well, that's amazing work that they're doing. And I mean, after, if you could share that with us, we'd love to share
Absolutely,
it on our podcast and on our social media as well. That's really great.
Oh, sure. I'll definitely do that, because I think the more people know about the work that he does, the better.
I think one final question I'd really like to ask you is, out of all the witches you've looked at so far, what is your favourite, most interesting story out of all of them?
It's funny because I don't want to say it's a Canadian trial, because it wasn't even a trial, but we did an episode about her and I had no idea that she even existed, because obviously in school you're not taught about witches, unfortunately. But it's from near our capital. She's called the Plum Hollow Witch, and she was actually very helpful. She was a woman from Ireland named Elizabeth Barnes, and she helped so many people, like, find lost animals, lost wallets. She helped solve a murder case. Yeah, so somebody, there was a cold case that's been going on, and the police were like, we don't know what to do. And they heard such good things. People would come from all over Canada, all over America, just to see Mother Barnes. And it wasn't like she was extorting people for their money. She was just like, oh, just give me some apples if you can't pay me, you know. She's very sweet woman from the sounds of it. And Yeah, she helped him solve a murder case. It ended up being that the cousin murdered his cousin and he was put in the bottom of a river, and the police couldn't find this. And they went to Mother Barnes and was just like, listen, we know you can help find stuff. Can you help us with this case? And she was just like, so I think it was a cousin and I think he's buried at the bottom of this lake. And sure enough, he was. She also predicted where the capital would be, because at that time we didn't have the capital, Ottawa. So it's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
I don't know how much of it I'm allowed to believe, because the science part of me is just like, how is this possible? But it's a case where it was very sweet. Nothing happened to her. She was very helpful, used witchcraft or fortune telling in a good way, and she wasn't persecuted for it. And I had no idea about this trial.
It was a happy ending. So it was
a witch that was
loved and respected, and it wasn't a bad thing to be a witch, and she just was able to live out the rest of her life happily.
Yeah, she lived till her 90s. She was a wee old woman in a cabin in the country doing fortune telling and tea readings, sort of tassiography. So that was really nice. And it wasn't until starting this podcast that I found out about her, and pretty local, just a 4-hour drive. So
I love her. I'm definitely going to research her. My family is Irish, and although I am a humanist and a rational person and don't believe any of that, simultaneously, I'm totally superstitious. My grand sisters, one of them was supposed to have sight. She could read the tea leaves and stuff like that. So those two sides of my brain just sit parallel to one another, not touching, because if they intersected, my brain would explode. I can't, but you can have just two going along at the same time. So I really look forward to having a wee look at her and find out where she came from. Elizabeth Barnes.
Elizabeth Barnes, if you Google her, probably Mother Barnes or Plum Hollow Witch, because she lived in an area called Plum Hollow. And if that isn't the most beautiful place
Perfect.
That you can think
Netflix
of, Plum Hollow.
Setting.
I know. Yeah.
Oh, well, it's been really fantastic talking to you. And we will, of course, put up all the links and everything at the end so that people can go and listen to your podcast too, because we're all about sharing as much information as we can and about talking about the issue of witches internationally. And it really is such a fantastic podcast. The stories are so fascinating, but it's been really great. And we should mention as well that Kayla's gotten up really early. She says it's not that early for her, but I think it's early. It's Saturday morning because she's in Canada. So it's sort of, it must be 8 a.m. there now, and it's 1 o'clock here now. So thank you so much for making time to talk to us this early on a Saturday.
Thank you for having me. If Steph was here, she'd be fangirling as much as I am on the inside, but I really appreciate it as well. And I hope that we'll have you on ours and we'll stay in touch for sure.
We'd love to. We'll keep going because it's really great hearing all the stories, and it's great to have a resource where it's stories that are international as well. It's brilliant. So thanks very much. Have a lovely day.
Thank you. You too.
Thanks for listening to us today. Remember, please do rate us on whatever app you use, and do add us to your automatic downloads, as it means that when the podcast comes out, you get it directly, and it helps with our statistics. The algorithm, it pushes, as soon as we've got the word algorithm, I'm like, I feel like I'm just going, I don't really know what that means. And I hear people talking about it. I think it's a magical thing where the computer puts in some figures and then it makes a whirring sound and it beeps and some lights flash. And then like a ticket comes out and the ticket tells your future. I think that's how an algorithm works. And then the algorithm will push our podcast up the list of podcasts, and it helps more people to know that we're there, and then we'll get more listeners, and then we've got more of a chance of being successful with our campaign. We didn't actually realize that the magical algorithm could be helped along in this way until very recently. I don't know if we've mentioned this before, but Claire and I are not experts in the area of podcasting or in various other areas. So it's all pretty new to us, and it just sort of happens by osmosis sometimes. But it turns out that even though we're not deliberately trying to manipulate anything, we've been doing very well in the podcast charts. So our highest placing so far has been in the Apple book charts, where we reached a staggering number 13. Any comment to be made on that number, Claire?
No comment whatsoever, Zoe.
Sensible. All the other podcasts are supported by big companies,
but we've charted higher, at least on that day, than the Guardian Books podcast, the Penguin podcast, and just behind Richard and Judy's book club. So not bad for a writer and a lawyer who don't quite know what they're doing. I mean, we do in other areas of our life. I don't want to give you the impression we're completely incompetent. It's just to do with the fact that we're learning as we go. We're experiencing and understanding our knowledge by doing, which is excellent educational practice. So that's very good. Please rate us and or comment and let the podcast world know about us. And also, if you can, where should people go to, Claire?
Well, they should head over to www.witchesofscotland.com, and if you're feeling generous, look for the merch button. All proceeds of the merchandise go towards payment for our very kind sound engineer. So if you enjoy the podcast, enjoy listening to it, please do consider buying a mug or some such.
I think it is important for me to point out here that we'll never charge for any events or anything to do with us. Okay, we think it's distasteful, in fact, to charge for events that are to do with this, because it's a campaign. So we very, very deliberately turned down offers of sponsorship, turned down offers of advertising up to this point, because they've not been the right fit for what it is that we're doing. It's not been dignified enough. Having said that, we have made David, Claire's brother, a sort of a prisoner of what we're doing, which is that he thought that initially he was just offering to do 6 episodes sound engineering. But as you know, this is the 44th episode and David is giving up his time every week. So any money that's made from the merchandise, which by the way is very nice, and I was just drinking out of my Black Witch's mug, which I love and gives me a little thrill each time I drink out of it, then the money goes directly to David, not to us. So please do consider buying stuff because it's pretty snazzy. And plus also people will know you're cool if you've got the mug or the hoodie or whatever.
People knowing you're cool.
People will know you're cool. I mean, come on. And please do get in touch with us. As we always say, the best place to get a chat is on Twitter, because that's the one where we're on there more and we can have a bit of a chat. We have got a Facebook page, but that's to give you info. We've got a YouTube channel, which we occasionally put stuff up on, but we're obviously going to use that more. But please do get in touch because we love to speak to you. Thanks very much.
Bye.
Ta-ra.
If you'd like to learn more about the Witches of Scotland, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Sign up for our mailing list at www.witchesofscotland.com to keep updated with the campaign. On that site, you'll be able to find how to link with us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram.